From the studios of WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. March is Women's History Month, and this month doesn't share the longevity of, say, Black History Month. It wasn't until 1981 that Congress passed a resolution asking the president to proclaim one week in March as Women's History Week. Over the next 5 years, Congress passed annual resolutions designating Women's History Week. It was 1987 when the National Women's History Project petitioned Congress to establish the entire month of March as Women's History Month. And that continues today. Each year, Congress asks the president to issue a proclamation. On today's edition of Coastline, we'll explore why there's a month set aside for women's history. We'll also find out what third-wave feminism is, how it's different from the first and second waves, and how feminists might say the culture is doing in terms of moving past gender stereotypes to equality. Joining us in the studio today is the director of the Women's Studies and Resource Center at UNCW. She's also an associate professor of English. Dr. Katie Peel, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you so much.
So often, Dr. Peel, people hear the term feminism and it conjures up all kinds of images, radical, angry women who are man-haters and hating all things masculine, burning bras and that sort of thing. And because of that, there have been at least a couple of generations that have distanced themselves from the notion of feminism or being feminist. When you use the word feminism, what do you mean?
Thank you for that question. There's certainly been a lot of resistance. And I think part of it comes from the fact that so many people just have these misperceptions. And what I like to do when I go into a classroom, for example, is I'll ask, okay, students, how many of you might be willing to admit that you are a feminist? And in a group of 30 students, I might get maybe a good three or four. If it's a women's and gender studies class, I might get a solid four or five. And then we talk about what it means, what feminism means, and what they think it means. And right, you know, when I say, okay, what do you imagine or what do you picture when I say there's a group of feminists down at, you know, the student union? You know, when we talk about, you know, we have this image of, you know, angry, hairy lesbians picketing something, right? Protesting because they're so very angry all the time. But when we talk about feminism today, and I'm going to be very, very reductive here, what it is simply the belief that people should be treated equally. And, you know, historically, it moved from, you know, initially it was the belief that people should be treated equally regardless of gender, right? Because that's what the issues we're focused on. But then, you know, people realized that we can't talk about justice regarding gender without taking on issues of race and class and ability and education and sexual orientation and age, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, and it became more and more inclusive. So now, you know, and again, this is boiling it down a bit, but what it's all about is just the belief that people should be treated equally regardless.
So you're talking about just the general idea of mm-hmm. equality among human beings.
Yeah.
Feminism is a word that implies a certain gender, does it not?
That's what people think. That's what people think. But we've moved beyond that. I mean, some of my best friends are you know, identify as both male and feminist, right? So feminism is, you know, this is the title of one of Bell Hooks' books, feminism is for everyone, right? You know, and if we, you know, so people do, I think you're right, people do get hung up on the name, on that particular word, and they hear woman or they hear, you know, the gender identified portion of that, and they don't realize that it's so much more.
Give us a little bit of historical context here. What was the first wave of feminism about?
Okay. First wave feminism was largely a one-issue movement, right? It kind of rallied around the issue of suffrage for women. I like to locate it as locate it with Mary Wollstonecraft as kind of feminist number one, right? So these ideas coming out of the Enlightenment, late 18th, early 19th century, and you know she wrote The Vindication of Rights of Woman, so kind of pioneering text there, and she was. She was naughty in all sorts of ways herself, so I'm a big fan. You know, she would get in trouble for you know, not wearing corsets and whatnot, and you know, so all that kind of good stuff. But and you know, not not coincidentally, we have the overlap between the first wave feminism and the abolitionist movement, right? So people were organizing and fighting for slaves to become free, right? And that's where we see again this idea of intersectionality. We can't be fighting for the freedom of one group of people without fighting for the freedoms of all peoples, and realizing that many slaves also identified as women, right? We can't fight for a group of women to vote when and talk only about that when we've got women who also identify as other races as well. So it's not just for white women, for example.
Was there crossover at the time between the suffragists and abolitionists?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And many people who identified as suffragists came straight out of the abolitionist movement. Frederick Douglass called himself a woman's rights man. So we've got that as well, too. But what we saw was that once with the passing of the 19th Amendment, the movement, for many reasons, fizzled a little bit, and part of that was because it had become such a, so devoted to this one particular issue, an important one, of course. But that, and then and different, World War I was in the middle of that as well. So there were different historical factors.
Is it easier to organize around a single issue kind of circumstance? I mean, when you're talking about just the right to vote, is that sort of an easier drum to beat or a clearer drum than, say, general equality among all human beings?
Oh, sure. I mean, because that when we're talking about organizing, the simpler the better, the clearer the better. When you're talking about marketing and branding and getting your message out, you don't want to make it too complicated. And I think that's where we get hung up on, in particular issues.
What about the second wave of feminism? When did that arrive and what was it about?
Okay, again, not coincidentally, we've got the civil rights movement coming, in the 50s and 60s. And again, too, we have people saying, we're fighting for these rights and voting rights. But hey, what's going on with women? We're doing all of this stuff women are still, getting shafted in many ways. So we have that coming about in the late 50s, early 60s and through the 1970s. And that's what we tend to think of, in terms of mainstream culture about feminism, like the women picketing for rights.
You say women getting shafted. And specifically, how did that manifest itself in that time?
A lot of awareness comes from, if we look at 1963, for example, saw the publication of Betty Friedan's Feminine Mystique, right? So we have, and again, too, still white middle class, upper middle class. I mean, she was a Smithy. But looking at, what options women had, particularly educated women, they were going to these fabulous colleges and getting married and staying home, right, which was, purported to be the ideal, the cultural ideal. And there was this lack there. But also, just in terms of basic rights, if even what I like to use in classes too, Jennifer Baumgartner and Amy Richards, who are very much involved in third wave feminism, have a brief essay in their book Manifesta called A Day Without Feminism. And it was looking at a day, I believe, in 1973, and just the landscape of America.
A typical day in 1973.
Typical day. Mm-hmm. And they look at how it was gendered versus today. And for example, the newspaper want ads were still divided by male jobs for men and jobs for women.
Were they really?
In 73. Women still had to ask for their husband's signatures to get a credit card, to get their own credit cards. And this is not that long ago. I mean, it sounds long ago for our students, but it's actually, within the lifetimes of many of us. In terms of women's health care, if they went in for exploratory surgery to have a lump removed, they might come out without a breast, right? They weren't necessarily asked for their consent, or maybe their husband gave consent to have that kind of surgery done. So
going back to the jobs issue, what kind of jobs were in the women's column and which jobs were in the men's?
You could probably make a good guess there. Anything domestic related, secretarial work, some teaching jobs would be in the women's column. Anything requiring more manual labor, more skilled labor would be in the men's column.
And do you know at what point that dropped off the landscape?
Oh man, I don't know in terms of the history of journalism when that happened.
Okay, well, we have just a couple minutes left in this segment, and when we come back, we're going to take some phone calls for people who have questions and comments about the topic. But why is it that in the 21st century, in 2015, we're still talking about equal rights for women? How does, in your view, inequality manifest itself today?
Because we're not there yet. That's why we're still, you know, because equality does not exist yet in our real lived experiences. There's still, for example, the gender, the wage gap, right? The disparity in pay, you know, across the board. And, you know, I checked last night, and the average is women tend to make, I think, 78 cents to the man's dollar, you know. So until it's, you know, it's a 1-to-1 ratio, we're going to have to be talking about making rights equal.
I think we've gone up a penny then in the last year or
yes,
so.
Yes, it was 77 for a while, but 1 cent, yay. until that is no longer an issue, we have to talk about it.
Right. We're talking with Dr. Katie Peel from UNCW's Women's Studies and Resource Center. If you have a question or a comment, you can give us a call at 910-343-1138. We're talking about third wave feminism, how gender equality issues manifest in our current culture. Have you ever catcalled a woman? Do you think that women enjoy an equal playing field, or do you think we have a long way to go? Give us a call, 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. This is Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. I'm here with Katie Peel from the Women's Studies and Resource Center at UNCW. We're talking about Women's History Month, third wave feminism, and how gender equality issues confront us today. You're invited to join the discussion. Do you think a glass ceiling still exists for women? Is there too much hysteria about the way women are portrayed in the media? How do you encounter gender stereotypes in your life? Give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also send an email to coastline@whqr.org or tweet us at coastlinehqr. Katie Peel, there are some notions about traditional femininity. And you have studied Victorian literature, for example, which is where a lot of these notions came from. Is that correct?
We tend to associate it with the Victorians, yeah, and their separate spheres ideology. Yeah.
What are some of those characteristics of this so-called traditional femininity?
Sure. Having to do with locating the woman in the home, right? This idea that the public space is for men, the private space, the home space is for women, and therefore women are unfit for things that happen in the public. For example, work is one of those things, but also anything having to do with anything political ideas, etc.
Okay, and is that something that you think is still present today? That a notion like that?
Oh, sure. I mean, we're still having these conversations about should women go back to work after having children, right? So that comes up regularly. So, and that's largely rooted in this idea that women are the ones who ought to stay at home and be the guardians of hearth and home, right?
We hear so much about biology and anthropology versus social conditioning and social constructs. So many people will say things like, you know, feminine people are naturally passive, they're receptive, peacemakers. Is that a function? Does it fall somewhere on a spectrum, or is that strictly a social construct? Could that be part biology? How does that fall into a feminist view of the world?
I would encourage people to at least think of it as being on a spectrum that allows for more flexibility, I think. I would also encourage people to remember that when we're thinking about these biological arguments, that even the ways that we think about science and understand science are socially constructed, right? I mean, years ago, maybe 10 years ago or so, a study came out saying that the way that we had, that we've been talking about, for example, conception, is actually not the case. Like, we, you know, when we learn about it in school, you know, the egg is just kind of passively lying there and waiting for, you know, the strong swimming sperm, you know, to implant. And then, you know, the study came out and said, well, actually, there are these little cilia on the egg that actively draw the sperm in. So how have we been thinking about that and gendering just that act? Right? And that's socially constructed. So I would like to, you know, encourage people to think of it at least as a blend or somewhere on the spectrum, if not more socially constructed than not.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Dr. Katie Peel from UNCW's Women's Studies and Resource Center about Women's History Month and third wave feminism and what gender equality issues still confront us today. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. And we have an email from Jim who says, do female students and young women in general realize that there has been a steady battle, he says, from the religious and political right against their right to control their own bodies? Are they concerned about it? Are they willing to fight back? How would you respond to that, Dr. Peel?
First of all, thank you for the question, Jim. It depends on the student, right? Some students, I would be very wary of generalizing here, but some of our students are very, very actively involved and politically aware. For example, we have a student NARAL organization that is our reproductive justice organization, and they are very much involved in keeping other students aware. But, you know, it's very easy for all of us, but particularly for college students, you know, taking a number of courses and probably working jobs, to live in their own kind of bubble and disengage from the world beyond. So that's one of our problems. And part of that is also too with the strides that we've made with second wave feminism. We have the luxury, and young people have the luxury today, of thinking that, wow, look, we've made so much progress. We can relax now, right? But certainly that's not the case, and that's dangerous.
And, you know, we're also getting into some potentially divisive waters here when we associate gender equality issues with political positions. Is that something that you can tease apart? I mean, you know, in Jim's email, he's talking about the conservative right. Mm-hmm. But is it possible that there are conservative right-wingers who still very much see gender equality issues as something worth striving towards?
I would certainly hope so. That, my goodness, I hope so.
I mean, can you take this out of the politics is what I'm asking.
Right. It's hard to. It's hard to, especially in today's political climate, when so much, even if looking at our own state, so much of the recent legislature is targeting issues of women's health, right? And not only issues of women's health, but other feminist issues, like targeting our education system. All of those, the legislation targeting voting access, these are all very much feminist issues. And so it's hard to extricate that right now from the political scene.
We had a caller who didn't want to go on the air, but she left a comment. Carolyn says, the company that I've worked for, which is a very large company here in town, discourages employees from letting others know how much money we make. That's not uncommon, I have to say. I have a PhD, she says, and I know that some of the guys coming in make a lot more money, though they have a lot less experience.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
Is that something, Dr. Katie Peel, that is a common? We were talking earlier about the wage gap and how we've narrowed it by a penny. Yeah. You said we're now at 78 cents on the dollar versus men. How is that measured and how prevalent is it?
Unfortunately, far too prevalent, right? And there are distinctions across disciplines, but largely, you know, and it is an average, certainly. Largely, it's... I mean, it's still there. If we look at in terms of wages, in terms of distribution of jobs, I mean, I think the Chronicle of Higher Education just published yesterday that only, I want to say, 4% of university presidents are women, right? So when we're talking about the glass ceiling, I mean, that's job number one right there in terms of the higher education ladder. And there's still an inequality there.
Is it ironic that in the world of academia, which is so much about ideas, that some sort of general stodginess might exist there?
Yeah, sadly.
Is it possible that women play a role in that? I mean, how is there a danger in saying there's a glass ceiling or there's an obstacle for women or there's something in their way? Is there a danger that that will become a self-fulfilling prophecy for some women?
Perhaps. And it's certainly, you know, when we say that there are these obstacles, we don't always mean men, right? But women can be some of the worst enemies against other women. And many of these are institutionalized practices, right? So it's not just that we're fighting individuals. It's on a number of levels. And going back to Carolyn's issue, a lot of, you know, change has to happen on a lot of levels. We've got companies needing to actively monitor and address these issues within their own practices. We've got policy makers. The Equal Pay Act hasn't been updated, I think, since 1963. And then on an individual level, again, going back to that socialization, right, men are socialized to negotiate those job offers in ways that women aren't, you know, and that's the American Association for University Women runs annually a Start Smart workshop, and Dr. Michelle Scanton-Tessier is running that for us next week for our university women students, just to teach them ways to negotiate their first job offer, because when I was offered the job for the director of the Women's Studies and Resource Center, I knew that, especially coming into this job, I had to negotiate, right? Because that's what I had to do. One of the first things in my head was, wow, but I don't want them to think that I'm greedy, right? So, and that's how we're socialized, even though we know better. So, a lot has to happen.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about Women's History Month, third wave feminism, and how gender equality issues still crop up today. With us to answer your questions, Dr. Katie Peel, director of UNCW's Women's Studies and Resource Center. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call at 910-343-1138. And Hank, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air. Or is this Peter?
Oh, it's Peter.
Hi, Peter. Sorry about that.
Hi.
Welcome to Coastline.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling because I have a rather unusual perspective on this. I'm a non-traditional male, and I do believe that women will never get what they're looking for in terms of equality until there's a recognition that men also are in need of liberation, and there's resistance from both men and women alike for men to change and to embrace parts of themselves that we traditionally classify as feminine behavior.
And Peter, can you tell us specifically what ways you think men need to be liberated? Specifically, how do the limits manifest themselves for you?
Well, the limits manifest themselves from a standpoint of what men... I understand that women are limited in terms of how they are... the opportunities from financial and job and other opportunities. But men are limited from a perspective of how they're allowed to express themselves. They are basically told that anything that we perceive as feminine is off limits to them. So they are kind of put in a little box and basically society insists that they do A, B, and C. And that anything over on the other spectrum of gender continuum is off limits. And not only is it off limits, but if they do express a desire for anything along those lines, they will be treated not very nicely from both sides.
There will be consequences for that. And Peter, it's interesting what you're talking about is these traditional notions of femininity, the feminine stereotypes, are putting men in a box, is what you're saying.
They are putting men in a box. And because of, I think, early feminism that rejected certain behaviors from men, men were told basically that as they had been previously living was not any longer acceptable. But they had no place to go as an alternative, because if they behaved in a different way, such as if they were more expressive, then that was also condemned. So they really had no place to go.
Dr. Katie Peel, what would you say to Peter in this notion that he's in a similar circumstance, he feels?
Right. And thank you, Peter, for your input. And I agree with you in that gender roles and stereotypes limit everyone, right? It's, you know, I mean, the feminist movement, we think of women's rights as fighting just for this one particular gender, but there are many genders, of course, and no one wins. Well, no, I'm not going to say that, but because certain people do win. But gender roles and stereotypes limit everyone. And part of, you know, we've seen historically what began as women's studies programs, many are now morphing into women's and gender studies programs, right, to bring this critical lens to all genders and study different, you know, masculinities, right? The masculinity studies is now being integrated into women's and gender studies. And, for example, we have this semester, one of our women's and gender studies instructors is teaching a course on masculinities in film, right, which explores, you know, all of the, you know, a range of ways to be masculine, incorporating, you know, like what we think of as traditionally more feminine qualities.
Dr. Peel, why is it so threatening for some people to have men or women come at these non-traditional gender stereotypes? I mean, why does Peter, for instance, suffer when he might embrace what might be called a traditionally feminine side of himself, or express in a way that our culture today might categorize as feminine? Why is that so threatening?
Right. I wish I could tell you if I knew. It has to do with power. It has to do with power, and it has to do with fear of change. So, and people get nervous when they can't identify something, when they don't recognize something, and it largely has to do with our own our securities and insecurities about ourselves and what it means for ourselves.
Peter, thank you so much for your call. You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about Women's History Month, what we still have to learn, how the expression of gender equality is changing, and what role third-wave feminism plays in all of this. We're talking with Dr. Katie Peel, director of UNCW's Women's Studies and Resource Center. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. And I think we have Hank now on the line. Hank, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, everybody. Hi, Dr. Peel.
Hi, Hank.
Good to hear from you. Hey, my question is, I guess, kind of based around the history section of Women's History Month. And it's in response to, I guess, Peter's comments about traditional masculinity and also to the earlier discussion of first and second wave feminism. And that's, I mean, for me, what I found has been one of the most kind of startling and crucial insights of feminism is the reconsideration of history through the perspective of gender, right? So this thing that we call, you know, traditional masculinity or femininity isn't kind of something that exists outside of history. It's something that was constructed at a specific time for a specific reason as a response to specific social and economic circumstances. And so my question is, I guess I'd just ask you to speak a little bit to this whole idea of feminist reconsideration of history through that lens.
Okay. Thank you, Hank. I appreciate that. We can, part of the second wave feminist movement was largely invested in these recovery projects, right? Because part of the thing was, in terms of history and women's writing, much of that was lost, right? Because it wasn't celebrated, it wasn't valued. When we think of, you know, Hank, I know that you know literary history. You know, when we talk about literature, you know, we're still very much invested in the canon, which tends to be a lot of writing by straight white men, who might also be dead, right? So there's that, and so part of the second wave movement was to go back and recover a lot of women's work, a lot of women's history, a lot of women's narratives and experiences, right? And make those visible, make those more known, and then part of that was going back to the history that we did know or thought we knew, and look at it again through the critical lenses of gender and then class and race and all of that as well. And it brings to a different but a newer and hopefully more more comprehensive understanding.
And it's interesting you talk about recovery work. Zora Neale Hurston's work was part of that, wasn't it?
Yes, yes.
And Alice Walker. Walker played a role in that. And you did, we're going to break in just a couple of minutes, but you did some local recovery work with your students and discovered something about one of the buildings on the UNCW campus. Is that right?
It wasn't me, but it was Dr. Sarah Hollenbeck. And I believe Hank actually might have been in that class. I'm not remembering exactly, but Shannon Morton, she's the woman the English department building is named after, and they went to our local archives and dug up material about her, and I believe we'll be presenting it locally.
Do you know when that'll be presented?
Oh, goodness.
Still,
my guess is that it will be part of the English in Action showcase, which will probably be at the end of April.
Okay. Hank, thank you so much for your call. We have a quick email. Gender equality, does Dr. Peel? And we'll get to this after the break. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM, and that's from our friend Anne. We'll read her email in just a moment. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn, and with me in the studio is Dr. Katie Peel from UNCW's Women's Studies and Resource Center. If you have a question or a comment, you can give us a call at 910-343-1138. We're talking about Women's History Month and how this history can be an indicator, the way we treat it, of current gender equality issues. We'll be back in 90 seconds. You're listening to Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn, and with me in the studio once again, the director of UNCW's Women's Studies and Resource Center, Katie Peel, is also an associate professor of English, and we're talking about Women's History Month, how gender equality issues and third wave feminism are expressing in our culture today. If you have a question for Dr. Peel or a comment, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. And we have an email I promised we'd get to after the break from Anne. She says, does Dr. Peel have a perspective about education salaries and historically female majority employees? As a retired North Carolina teacher, I believe that one of the reasons we can't seem to get teacher pay to come even close to other industry pay scale is that it is still viewed as women's work. Dr. Peel, what would you say to Anne?
Anne, I suspect you're right. And I don't want to get too much into that issue right now because North Carolina is kind of off the charts in terms of public teacher pay. We can, you know, Texas is recruiting our public teachers right now, so our public school teachers. But if we think about that, yeah, I mean, think about just looking at people who cook and who become chefs for a living, right? When it was not as valued, when it was primarily a woman's job. People didn't make a lot of money doing that, but now look at the celebrity chefs. Look at, you know, the names that we know and that are promoted, and you know all of our TV shows and whatnot. Those people are paid the big bucks, and it's a much more masculine profession these days.
And you were talking, Dr. Peel, earlier about negotiating and how.
Yeah.
Men are inclined to walk into a job offer situation and know that they need to negotiate. And you shared that when you were faced with that same circumstance, you felt as if you might be perceived as greedy. Caddy Kay of the BBC and Claire Shipman of ABC News, respectively, they wrote a book together about this documented gap in the confidence levels between men and women. And they happened upon this topic after they'd both interviewed female world leaders, politicians, scientists, notable women, and they found a similar thread, which to them was shocking enough to dive into the research and write a book about it. So let's listen to this clip.
And we kept coming across phrases like, I'm just lucky to have got there. I was just in the right place at the right time. And actually what we found was wells of self-doubt. among women. And so we started to look into the research to see if there really was such a thing as a confidence gap between men and women. And the statistics were extraordinary. We talked about this earlier in the program. Men overestimate their abilities by 30% on average. Women tend to underestimate their abilities. There was a study done in the UK asking young graduate students, what do you deserve to earn 5 years out of college? The men would say, I think I deserve to earn $80,000. The women would say, I think I deserve to earn $64,000. It's a 20% gap in what we feel we deserve.
A 20% gap in what women typically feel they deserve compared to the men that they're sitting next to in class and on the bus or the subway and in traffic. Where does that come from, Dr. Peel?
We're socialized that way, right? We learn confidence. We learn self-doubt. This is apparent, too, in kind of an alarming way. The way that we talk to babies, if we go to meet someone's new baby or whatever, it's entirely gendered, right? If it's a little boy, first of all, it's, very hetero, right? He's going to be a lady killer. He's going to be so tough, so strong. And we use a lot of fighting rhetoric, right? If it's a female baby, we say, oh, she's so pretty, so dainty, so cute, and we start projecting that stuff. So of course, women are going to be to grow up and think that they need to be more modest, that it will be unseemly if they even appear to be confident, right? They'll be knocked down. That the whole discussion of the word bossy, right? That's what that's all about.
Is there some truth to that? If a woman does present in public as a confident woman who is assertive with her ideas, will she be punished for that somehow?
Oh, sure. At the very least, just by other people's perceptions, right? But it can have more damaging consequences as well in terms of in the workforce, right? She might not be chosen for certain projects or promoted if she's seen as because bossy for a woman is seen as a negative thing, right? And who wants to work with someone bossy as opposed to reframing that as leadership qualities, I want to be on a team with a strong, with a leader. So that can have very very real consequences.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Dr. Katie Peel about Women's History Month and what we still have to learn, how the expression of gender equality is changing, and what role third wave feminism plays in all of this. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. John from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. How are you?
I'm really enjoying this topic, and I really think this is probably the most important thing going on today, and maybe even a civil rights kind of aspect. But going to that, vein, recently Patricia Arquette stood up at the, I guess it was the Grammys, Oscars, whatever, and criticized because she didn't frame this argument as an argument for all women, it seemed. It's time to stop the civil rights movement, it almost sounded like, and let's focus on women's equality. And all the backlash that kind of happens within the feminist movement seems to almost hinder this beautiful thing that we see all over the place. Cinderella being criticized because you got to marry a wealthy man takes that Frozen thing that our daughters learned, my daughter learned, and wipes it all off the map instantly. And then the movie coming out now, right? So and just understanding what third wave feminism is interesting to me because I really don't know.
Even in the media, Dr. Peel, especially in the media, we see some of these traditional images reinforced. And as John is talking about, I heard some people talk about Frozen and say it's really a lesbian love story here when it's actually, I think, about two sisters. But there had to be a sexual component introduced, in other words, because the woman at the end who is the hero is not rescued by a man. Why are we still encountering stereotypes like that? And what was this? He raised the issue of Patricia Arquette and the feminist backlash. Can you tell us about that? That was at the Oscars.
Right, sure. There's a lot in there. Okay. So I'll try to be as organized as possible. In terms of just quickly Frozen, first of all, nothing wrong with a sister saving a sister, right? And I would encourage you, anyone who likes Frozen, please go read Goblin Market by Christina Rossetti. That's my little 19th century plug. So there's that. Patricia Arquette, my heart goes out to her because
I do not deal well when asked questions on the spot. And, you know, when she had her prepared statements and gave the shout out for equal pay, that was a beautiful moment. And what I love even more, too, was the response by Meryl Streep and J-Lo, you know, saying, you know, right on. That was awesome. And then she was asked more questions, you know, behind the stage. And she, you know, she meant well. She was making a plug for gender equality. And the way it came off was that, you know, that were these different factions and that it's everyone's turn. And she's being critiqued for not making her argument intersectional, right? Not realizing that we can all work together and that there are people who identify as, you know, as women of color, right? And, you know, and so the civil rights movement, you know, is necessarily and has to be, you know, this intersectional, you know, in meeting that it takes into account multiple identities movement. What tends to happen, though, is, you know, in this case with Patricia Arquette or, you know, Beyonce saying she's a feminist or whatever is, you know, it's great in that we get to have this conversation, right? It wrenches this conversation into mainstream media. And so we get to talk about this. But more often than not, it gets stuck on, oh, I love Beyonce. No, I hate Beyonce, right? And so that's kind of where we leave it, and we don't pursue these conversations. But yay for getting this topic out there. And, I mean, you know, all of the social media was all over this for a little while after.
John, thanks so much for your call. USA Today just published a story about how all four military services are on track to open all military jobs to women by next year and expect rules for those changes to be in place by this fall. And that USA Today story was preceded by a piece on 60 Minutes over the weekend in which they were looking at the Marines and how there's a three-month infantry officer course and no women yet have been able to make it through the physical demands of that course. Every single woman that has attempted it has had to drop out. And despite that zero success rate, Brigadier General George Smith, the officer in charge of that program, tells the reporter, "The Marine Infantry Officer course is designed just right. There are no plans to change it." And this is an interesting point that he makes. He says, "The realities of combat aren't going to change based on gender. The enemy doesn't care whether you're male or female." Is this a gender equality issue, or is he right? I mean, doesn't it, you can make the argument that you need a certain level of defensive force, and why would you lower those standards? There are biological differences, are there not, between men and women?
To some extent, yes. And so I'm sure to some extent that this is a gender equality issue in terms of what we would look for is certainly access, right? It's about much more about access issues.
Yes, and certainly women in the military, that's been an issue because there's been something of a glass ceiling because women haven't been accepted and credited for having been in combat zones. That's been part of the issue. So it's been a rank issue. It's been a salary issue. But when you're talking just about the physical demands, where do we go with that from an equality issue?
That's a tricky question because certainly the demands of battle and war require the ability to perform certain tasks, right? I don't know enough about military action to feel that I can make an informed statement about that. But I would be concerned about issues of access and education, and that's where I would leave that.
That's fair. There was a video. I want to make sure that we get to this. A video that went viral, and I think this was last year, produced by an organization called iHollaBack.org. You know what I'm talking about, Dr. Katie Peel. And this was a video that showed a young woman walking through the streets of New York City. She was wearing a crew neck t-shirt and jeans, you know, basically normal street clothes. And a camera followed her for 10 hours as she walked through the streets. She got a lot of male attention, people saying, "Hello, hey, baby, how you doing?" You know, it was really, when she didn't respond to people, one man said, "Hey, why wouldn't you thank somebody for telling you that you're beautiful?" What is that, and why did that video go viral? Why did that capture the cultural and societal imagination so much? It struck such a nerve.
I think because so many people have experienced it, so many people could relate to it and have been bothered by it. And it's one of those things where it tends to happen to people when they are alone. I mean, sometimes it happens when people are in groups, but so it can feel isolating. It can feel like one is being targeted and victimized, and it's not something that one necessarily wants to broadcast, right? Or, you know, because it makes us feel bad, or it can make us feel bad. So seeing that it happens to other people in such a blatant way is kind of this this rallying moment, right? And I think that's what made it so popular.
There was a response to that, a YouTube response, and I want to point out that this response is probably in the minority, but I don't think that it's so far from what a lot of people might privately think, which is why I think we should listen to this, and then I want to hear Dr. Katie Peel, your response. Here we go.
Apparently, when a woman goes out and deliberately wears tight jeans that are specifically designed to accentuate the shape of her ass to attract the opposite sex, and the jeans accomplish their intended goal of attracting the opposite sex, you're somehow a street harasser if you take the bait. And don't tell me, but she has to wear something. Yeah, she does, but let's be honest. She doesn't have to wear excessively tight jeans because jeans aren't the most comfortable clothing, especially when they're so tight that they cut the circulation to your legs. Excessively tight jeans serve a very deliberate function for women, attracting a sexual partner.
There are men that think women dress for that purpose. What would you say to that?
That's just blatant victim blaming, right? Which is dangerous and damaging, you know, culturally for people of all genders, right? It's horrible to, you know, to blame the victim regardless of gender, but that also gives these guys no credit at all. Really, you can't control yourself because of a pair of jeans? You know, what's that about? So yeah, that's ridiculous.
And this behavior is so prevalent because we've seen other catcall videos go mm-hmm. viral. I mean, there was a video, I think, out of Brazil where it was all, you know, it was not in English, but there were helpful subtitles. And it was women who had been dressed up by makeup artists to parade in front of, in wigs and high heels and, you know, low-cut dresses, to parade in front of men who had been called sexual harassers, and these were their sons. And then the mother would walk by, and the son would say something, and the woman would turn around and say, "What are you doing?" And,
that's one of my favorites.
but obviously these videos keep popping up because right. this is so common all over the world. Right. What is there to be done about that?
Oh, goodness. Well, if you are looking for something to do, the Hollaback movement, and I'm blanking on her first name. Her last name is May, but
Emily May.
Emily May. Thank you. And she came to UNCW last year. She was part of this. But there's an app. There's an app for that. There's an iHollaback app, or you can go to iHollaback.com and report it. If you experience street harassment, you can report it, and it's a contribution to a map. So again, this kind of awareness raising and consciousness raising. It's been going around, and
finish your thought.
Sorry. People are starting to work on comebacks, what to say back, and I love the commercial for the new Kimmy Schmidt show where she says, you know, "I wish I were your yellow hat," to the construction guy who catcalls. So we're working on it.
Okay. Dr. Katie Peel, thank you so much for joining us today. That's this edition of Coastline. Thanks also to you, our listeners, and those of you who called in and emailed your comments. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Join us for the next Coastline. It's the Clothesline Muse. Grammy Award-winning singer Nina Freelon joins us to talk about her show Coming to Keenan and her residency at Williston Middle School, documenting history through art. That's next Wednesday at noon here on HQR News 91.3 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.